And I'm Lua, and this is episode 2 of The Superheroes of Los Angeles.
A podcast about the awesome people who make Los Angeles a better place to live, work, and play.
Today we're talking to Jenny Carey, Director of Development and Evaluation at the Los Angeles Education Partnership. All right, so Jenny, community schools is a national movement that looks different in different parts of the country. Can you talk a little bit about those differences and what causes them and what the LAEP model looks like?
So community schools is really about making sure all the different parts of a student's life and a student's day are aligned as best as possible so that a student can thrive. So that can mean any kind of supports, or that can mean all the different relationships in a student's life, or just making sure a student has relationships or even has food. I think one of the main reasons it looks different in different parts of the country is access to funding quite a bit. So, for example, in some parts of the country, the community schools movement is funded by after-school funding, so the 21st century funds that a lot of states are giving out or often have something to do with community schools, or they make it to be about community schools, which is a great way to fund the community schools movement, but isn't necessarily the way that everyone does it, or isn't always perhaps the best way. So what LAEP does is we fund the community schools work, or we focus our energy on the community schools work from the perspective of aligning resources and coordinating resources, and not just limiting ourselves to the after-school element of it. So sometimes it makes it a little bit harder for us because we're not able to use some of the federal or state dollars, but it also gives us more freedom to be a little more neutral and to work with a different set of partners and to work with the entire day or the entire school day as opposed to just the after school hours. So that's what I think makes us a little bit unique in our perspective.
How many people or organizations are doing it that way? Like, what's the predominant approach to community schools? Or does it really differ kind of across the board?
It really does differ. So I'm on the what's called the core team for the National Coalition for Community Schools. And we were actually having a conversation about funding and sustainability, for example, about a month ago. And even among the maybe 8 or 10 of us on the call, there wasn't sort of, you know, it wasn't half and half. It wasn't obvious agreement. It did start as a conversation about those after-school dollars, but then quickly popped up that not all of us were funded that way. And it also sort of depends on the priorities of other agencies. So, for example, nationwide, there's a lot of funding from the United Way. But the United Way in Los Angeles uses its funding elsewhere. So it just sort of depends on a lot of different factors.
So, Jenny, in Portland, Oregon, the Sun School model is funded through county dollars, and that's been a really sustainable model for them up north. And I think it's been going on for about 20 years now, and they've expanded outside of Portland Public School District into neighboring school districts. Do you think that's something that could be duplicated here in the LA area or in California?
I don't know if it could be duplicated in LA, at least LA proper. I think one of the big challenges that LA faces, similar to New York, is that we're just such a big school district. And the school district isn't necessarily even geographically aligned with the county or the cities. Using, for example, small cities like San Fernando or Santa Monica, you know, or just the way the counties and the cities and the school districts work. I don't know 100% how it works in Portland, but I think just the large size and the lack of alignment would make it really, really difficult in LA unless there were some other significant structural changes in addition to just having conversations across the education and the policy and government type of worlds.
So, Jenny, I feel like we should go backwards. Can you tell us, because I know that you're passionate about community schools, but could you tell us, you know, what is it that, what led you to it, and what keeps you really vested and excited and passionate and working on community schools?
So my passion around this topic dates back to before I knew what community schools were. When I was an undergraduate student, I decided that I was going to become a teacher. And sadly, it wasn't because I was just so passionate about teaching so much as I wanted to support young people, and I thought the best way to do that was in a school because they were a captive audience for about 8 hours a day. But I also was excited about the idea that being a teacher meant I had a summer, and so I used my summers to get to know the nonprofits in Washington, D.C., which is where I was living. So over the course of a couple years, I soon was able to bring nonprofit partners to either my classes or the student groups I worked with. But I realized very quickly that the second that I was going to leave my school, if that were ever to happen, that all those relationships were to be gone. And that really what was bringing us all together were the students, but that there was sort of some disconnect between what these nonprofits were doing, what the school was doing, and yet the nonprofits needed the school and the school needed the nonprofits. So I became really interested in the idea of building sustainable partnerships between schools and just anyone outside of a school and using students as sort of the motivation for bringing everyone to the table. And that was why ultimately I left teaching and ended up moving into the world of community schools and family engagement and things like that.
Could you, Jenny, go even further backwards? Not further backwards.
Sure.
Teacher. But just talk about what your work was like, your day-to-day life was like as a community school coordinator before you transitioned into development.
The day-to-day life of a community school coordinator is pretty unpredictable. On some days, it involves meeting with teachers and looking at what their needs might be. On some days, it's being the college counselor, depending on what resources are there. On some days, it's organizing meetings to bring community partners and teachers and students and administrators and families to look at maybe some common issues or common data or things like that. And on some days, it's being the extra body in the room for an event or planning a lesson with some teachers and trying to bring in some partners. It's really a very adaptive job. I think that's what I liked about it, because even though I had a lot of hand or a lot of control over being strategic about our work, it always required me to be on my toes and to really be listening to the people around me so that I was doing what they needed and making sure that they, especially the students, stayed at the center of everything going on. And that the work really wasn't about me. And I think that's a really big challenge in any position, but especially a community school job, because you certainly want to get the work done, but you really are empowering other people to do the work and empowering students to be able to have the lives that they want to have.
You brought up capacity building, and you talked about sustainability, and you talked about relationships. And, you know, relationships are at the heart of so much of community schools work. What does a truly sustainable community school model look like? Because once you take out one coordinator and you put in another one, things change. So could you talk about what sustainability in the community school model looks like and what your thoughts are on that since you have left the school site?
And I can't say that I have it all figured out, but I think one piece of sustainability is not just building the coordinator relationship with the people around them, but building the people-to-people relationship. So the example I used to use, and I still do, is that sometimes I would get a teacher who would walk down to my office and say, "Jenny, I really need to connect with our college access partner. Can you please help me?" And I'd sit there wondering to myself why they didn't just literally walk to the next door over where the college center was. And I always just thought it was so funny that they would come to me because people didn't know who was in that room. And not knowing someone or feeling like even if I do know that someone, there's going to be turnover in that position, so it doesn't matter. That whole lack of a relationship really dictated a lot of how the work went down and why I even had a job. So one of the big things I focused on for the sustainability of the community schools work at my school was trying to make the relationship not about me, and to try and help people learn how to trust people, the other people, be it a parent or a community partner, and really build that culture of trust and that it's going to be okay, and foster a culture where people could feel safe, you know, building relationships and things like that. I think the other thing that helps with sustainability is building a culture around data, because data allows people to have conversations not about themselves generally, but about something on a page. And it removes that sort of personal element of it that can sometimes have people take things too much to heart or get too sensitive, and instead have a much more productive and fruitful conversation that's measurable and actionable.
What kind of data do you collect to show the impact of community schools?
That's a really touchy topic for a lot of schools. So we collect everything from grades to attendance to participation, if we can, in after-school activities, parent engagement. One of the big things we're looking at right now is that with the new data coming out for the core waiver districts, there's going to be more data on culture and climate and social emotional data. So we're really excited to see how we as a community partner can better support that. And that's sort of one of the benefits that a lot of the community schools nationwide are looking forward to in the new ESSA, that schools will have the opportunity to work more with partners to improve, as opposed to just schools being held accountable to themselves.
You're starting to look at this now from the development side. Can you talk about the difference between being on the ground and being in development?
I would say the biggest difference between being on the ground and being in the office, for lack of a better explanation, is I feel like I'm not empowering as much people to tell stories as I'm telling the story so that they can then have the opportunity to do the work. I don't know if that made any sense, but it makes sense to me.
It does, yeah.
But just that, I think the other thing is just the level of activity. You know, at a school site, there's sort of this constant reactiveness going on. And while that's the same at the office, there's still sort of some reaction that's going to happen. It's dealing with things at a different level and sort of seeing the bigger picture and trying to understand how to move the pieces to get the best outcome for everybody. And it's hard. It's a lot of difficult decisions because I know who the people are on the ground. You know, there are people I still talk to and people I still care about. I know the students who are impacted. It's not like I forget who they are. But I also, I see all the other work happening, and it's just different than being at the school site where you're reacting to the moment, whereas now you're reacting to the larger educational landscape. And it can't be ignored.
Now that you're in development, I'd imagine you're writing a lot about the impact of the work. So can you talk about the impact of community schools and what you've seen at the school level, where, you know, where you're at, and also nationally?
The impact that I'm seeing is that students have the opportunity to dream and to achieve more than they ever could have, because there are opportunities and relationships and just people being put in front of them that they wouldn't have known existed. And I would say the same kind of goes for the teachers we're impacting in the schools. Everyone is working so hard right now in South Los Angeles and Northeast Valley and East Los Angeles, everyone's really working hard. But sometimes when, you know, you're working hard, you can't always know what everyone else is doing, or it might feel like, oh, well, that works somewhere else, but it doesn't work here. But I think regardless, what I'm seeing is that there are just so many opportunities being put in front of our students and our families that otherwise wouldn't be there, because no one would have the time or the energy to react and bring it literally in front of their faces and make it happen.
How do you capture something like that? I mean, most funders really want, and not that LAP or community schools don't look at data as a really valuable and informative tool, but that's a really different kind of story to say, had this resource not been brought onto a campus, this family might not have, you know, and you follow that story. I mean, how do you capture that for funders, and not just for funders, but for people who are maybe interested in becoming involved, or for teachers, or for schools that are kind of considering the community school option? How do you translate that for somebody else?
Well, I think for funders, at the very least, you know, the way we report to our funders is a combination of, you know, data, like measurable, quantifiable data, but they also almost always ask, what lessons have you learned? What have been your successes? What have been your challenges? And we really make it a point to try and explain the impact of the numbers. So that could mean, you know, yes, we talk about, say, the number of students who attend a FAFSA workshop, or the number of students who participate in mock interviews. But we also then later talk about the lesson we learned that, hey, this makes them eligible for a workplace certificate, and that gets them eligible for an internship. And we explain how, you know, yes, we focused on mock interviews, but that also means that we were helping the teachers at the same time and building the capacity of the school, and that shifts the culture to being more about teacher leadership. So we try and really explain the impact. And funders are actually pretty interested in it. I think they're trying to be very smart about who they're investing in, because it's not like they have a ton of money sitting around either. So they're really thinking about it too. I think in terms of teachers and telling the story nationwide, the cool thing about this day and age is, you know, though it's not maybe data, it is sort of, you know, social media is making things a lot more possible. So the idea of just tweeting and things like this, like a podcast, stories are getting out. And I think it sort of puts the responsibility on all of us as, you know, practitioners and just the people doing the work to tell our own stories, because no one's going to tell it for us, not in the age of social media. No one's going to go out there and tell our story. I mean, very rarely. So, it, you know, we've made a bigger effort to tweet and to blog, and when we do get written up in research, to make sure that that's getting out, because if people don't know it, they just, you know, it might as well not have happened.
What does the future of community schools look like in Los Angeles and nationally? Do you see anything changing anytime soon, or funding sources changing?
There is a lot of hope that funding will continue, because of this new federal legislation, the Every Student Succeeds Act. It actually does have community school language in it for the first time, which, you know, should be a promising step towards some funding. It's not funded as well as anyone would like, but the fact that it made it into federal legislation is a pretty big deal for the community school movement as a whole. In terms of sort of the foundations and the other, I guess, funders out there, I think there is renewed interest in community schools. I think sometimes it has to be framed differently. So whether it's under the name of More and Better Learning Time, or Extended Learning Time, or Title I, or, you know, kind of, I don't want to say whatever you have to call it, but there are so many components to it. It's just finding, you know, where we align and finding where the schools align with us, and making it move forward. But there is increased, you know, legislation and funding around it, which everyone's taking as a good sign right now.
You've talked a lot about the impact for the students. Can you talk about how teachers respond to community schools and how administration and principals work with you on the ground, what that looks like, what the impact is for them?
We used to joke that community school coordinators were like Google, that, you know, you could ask the community school coordinator, sorry, a question, and, you know, all of a sudden you'd get, you know, this long list of answers. But I think it's a lot more than that. I think the real impact it has on teachers and on administrators is knowing someone else is looking out for them, and that someone else is also sitting at the table bringing the perspective of all the stakeholders who can't be in the room. So the example I use is, like, I used to sit in on instructional leadership team meetings. There's no possible way that you could have as many parents or community partners, you know, sit in on those meetings. And sometimes they were very closed door meetings that some pretty big decisions were being discussed, even if they weren't being made. And I knew that my job was to be the voice of the person not in the room. And it was really helpful to my principal and to my teachers that I was present, but then also that I could leave that meeting and bring their voices back to the partners, back to the teacher, back to the parents, and back to the people who I was representing previously. So it allowed me to be the go-between, and that really just allowed more work to get done. You know, when the teachers really don't have time to do that work on their own, or the principal doesn't, I mean, the teacher needs to focus on curriculum. They need to take care of the needs of the students. There are so many different things that have to happen in those, you know, short hours they get with the student in the classroom, that it's important to have someone there to be on your side, to be your advocate, to challenge you, but to be your ally at the same time. And so that's really, I think, what they valued the role for.
Yeah, teachers and principals and schools are tasked with so much. So it sounds like that's a huge added value to schools, having somebody there who can be that advocate and be that other voice for the families and the students, and especially from thinking about your background, that you came from the classroom previously. I'm sure that's really helped a lot, you know, to know what everybody is focusing on and doing. So do you still work? Are you still on the board of Youth Speak Collective?
I'm on the board of Youth Speak.
Cool. Okay, and so what do? Can you tell us a little bit about Youth Speak?
Sure. So Youth Speak Collective works in the Northeast San Fernando Valley, primarily in San Fernando, Pacoima, and Sylmar, but a couple other areas as well. And Youth Speak is a for youth, by youth organization. So they really take the youth voice and try and figure out what the youth want, what the youth think the community needs, and act on it. So that means that there's a community garden and that they provide youth leadership opportunities for students, and there's visual arts and there's digital arts. And but it's all because of what youth voiced as concerns and needs and solutions. So I got involved in Youth Speak because Youth Speak was one of the community partners I first worked with when I was at Sylmar High School. And I got to know the person who was involved with programs, but also the executive director. And I happened to see that they were looking for advisory council members, which was what I was on originally. So I got really interested in being involved because they were a for youth, by youth organization. And back when I was a teacher, I thought about starting my own for youth, by youth organization. And I eventually decided that wasn't what I wanted to do with myself, but I was really interested once I found out about the advisory council in trying to find a way that I could support their work and kind of live out my own previous dream through them.
What's something that you've seen that youth have advocated for that was surprising, or something that you didn't think that they would be asking for or thinking about?
One of the things I think I'm most proud of that Youth Speak did was they started women's circles. So one of the things that we see a lot in schools and in the community is girl-to-girl bullying, especially in the transition from middle school to high school. And The girls are actually really smart. They just get pretty caught up in social media and the bullying, and it really consumes their lives instead of being empowered to be them their full selves and not pick on other people and things like that. So we were able to start a women's circle thanks to Youth Speak, which came out of a student's idea. She said, you know, like these girls aren't bad people. They just need to believe in themselves more. And so we were able to take that youth's idea and create the Women's Circle, which I think has been going on for 3 or 4 years now.
Wow.
It's actually become a really good empowerment tool, not just for the girls who are bullying each other, but also for some of our English language learner girls who mm-hmm. sometimes feel a little bit marginalized, and it really brought them into the community and into the school and helped them find a place where they felt comfortable and involved.
Wow. That sounds really powerful. How many girls have been involved since you started, and how does it work? Are they leading the circle, or is somebody else facilitating it? Is there a curriculum, or how are they doing it?
Sure. There's a lead facilitator who's usually a college student or just out of college. And basically it's like a youth organizer position. And so I don't actually know how many girls have been involved since the beginning. On average, I think there's 10 to 15 girls per meeting, and I'm sure that rotates in and out a bit. And the students themselves somewhat drive the curriculum. So there's a curriculum and a set of lessons and topics that the girls can learn from and that the facilitator can use. But if they come up with something they want to learn about, and I think they do actually ask them and go through the process of sort of some needs assessment type of activities, then they restructure the curriculum and just adapt to what the girls say they need.
So, Jenny, we've talked about community schools and we've talked about LAEP, but we haven't talked about what LAEP stands for and what all the work of the organization is. Do you think you could give us kind of in a nutshell?
Sure. LAEP stands for Los Angeles Education Partnership. And the biggest thing that LAEP does is support students, families, and teachers in creating the strong communities that young people need to grow and thrive from diapers to diplomas, as we like to say. So that takes on a variety of forms, but really it's helping all those different people, the students, the families, the teachers, the schools, get access to what they need so that all students and all families can have a solid educational option in front of them, a high-quality educational experience, so that their students can grow up to be amazing individuals.
How should people get involved if they want to start supporting youth in some way?
I mean, they can always get involved with LAEP. We are in a lot of places. And they can find all the information on www.laep.org, and there's actually a volunteer tab. But I also just think, you know, go to your local school and ask, hey, how can I be helpful? And that may seem really awkward, and they might not know what to do with you, but asking people, you know, or just ask someone you know who has kids, hey, how can I support you and your kid? But I think being willing to listen and do what those people need as opposed to always coming in with a new idea can be one of the best ways to help. But like I said, if you don't know, just come to LAEP. We're always looking for people to do one-time volunteer opportunities through mock interviews or through job shadows. Or to help a student apply to college, even if you don't think you know how to do it, just we'll help you out. We'll train you. We'll find an opportunity that meets your needs. I think one thing LAEP has done really well in the last couple years is support volunteers and meet them where they're at, really find out what they're passionate about and connect them to a situation that they can really enjoy.
Okay, Jenny, so for the bucket list, what would you recommend or what's your favorite place in L.A.?
Dia de los Muertos at Hollywood Forever. I don't think there's anything like that anywhere. I mean, for one, anything in Hollywood Forever I just think is super unique to L.A. I don't know anywhere else where you go in the summer and watch movies in a cemetery. I just think it's really crazy. But I do think that the way they put on that Dia de los Muertos event is phenomenal. I've never seen anything like it. They celebrate Dia de los Muertos in other places in the U.S., but the one that we do, I think, is pretty amazing.
Big thanks to Jenny for sharing her story. If you want to learn more, go to lasuperheroes.com.
And be sure to check back next Tuesday for another Superheroes interview. Between now and then, follow us on Facebook and Twitter for up-to-the-minute highlights of local awesomeness. Bye!